Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Meet Ed Young, legendary author, illustrator, and one who has been forever drawn to telling stories. Welcome to All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 318 of the podcast with Ed Young. Ed has been making picture books for 50 years, back when he didn't even realize there was such a thing as children's books. Since then, his unique voice as an artist and storyteller has influenced countless illustrators making books for children. He's published over 70 books, and, in my humble opinion, his newest work is some of his best. We talk about The Cat from Hunger Mountain, his newest picture book as both author and illustrator, as well as Mighty Moby, a collaboration with Barbara DaCosta, who worked with Ed on Nighttime Ninja. Mighty Moby will release in August of 2017, and you'll want to be sure to put a reminder on your calendar. But for now, please enjoy my conversation with Ed. Here's episode number 318 of the podcast with Ed Young. Let me just say hello and thank you for making beautiful books, Ed.
Well, it's something I love to do, so partially it's doing it for myself, and I love telling stories. And I'm glad that it's received well. It means that it makes sense to people who read them. That's an added benefit.
Yes, you've been telling stories for some time now, and I love the way that your stories communicate a sense of storytelling and of a history and of an importance to the words in addition to the illustrations. I've always admired that in your work.
Thank you very much.
I read that as a young man you came to the United States from China. Is that right?
Yeah.
But you did not originally come to make children's books. You came for a different purpose.
I never thought, I never even knew there was such a thing as children's books when I first...
You know,
as it turned out, many people that I have become friends with in the field, I was in a panel with Peter Sis and Jerry Pinkney, and neither of them were anything. They were not into children's books when they first started. They didn't know why they got into children's books. So I'm not the only one. You know,
no.
there were many people who really didn't know that's where they're going to end up in.
Well, and what's so beautiful about that statement is that Peter Sis and Jerry Pinkney and you and others like you ended up really shaping what has become of children's books now. The golden age of picture books that we talk about is directly a result of work such as yours.
Well, we came from somebody too, you know.
Yeah.
We're not the pioneers. We have our heroes, you know. And it's just sort of like the baton's passed down into our hands, and then we just moved on from there.
Yes.
A lot of it is not intentional. We have no idea how we actually go about doing these things and what we end up doing. And these are basically unwitting in some ways, but then we love what we do, so we continue to be in it for this long.
Well, I love that it has continued to give and to give to you, and I can imagine you've met hundreds and thousands of children, of readers, over the time that you've been creating your picture books.
Yes. For a while, I haven't. I think in the first 20 years or so, I haven't really visited that many places. I love telling stories, but I never really thought of telling story to children in particular. In China, telling stories is basically for all audiences. There are storytellers that tell stories, but then just like comics, it's read by adults as well as children. It's for everybody. So when I start telling stories, it was just, I love the stories that I tell.
I love the stories that you tell too.
it's appealing to children because not until I had children of my own, I never really thought of telling stories for just children. And my picture books in those days were actually basically adult looking.
Hmm.
And then I started to read children's books when I started to have children, and then I realized there is an entirely different thing altogether. In the older age, you know, after 20 years or so, my work began to start to appeal to children.
Yeah.
Because I had children of my own. So, and then I also started to visit schools and meeting children of their age, and then that became an entirely different thing. So I'm growing also as I'm in the field.
Yes. Ed, who were those artists that you saw making children's books that inspired you to go into trying your hand at the same thing?
When I started to do children's books, I didn't have any heroes. Maybe the Provincens, I think. You know Provincens, Martin and his wife, the two of them,
yes.
Husband and wife. They actually did a lot of golden books then. I love their style. Many of the, like Leo Leone was another one that was ahead of me. At that time, he was an art director for Scorcher magazine. He didn't do illustrations, but he was a good designer, and I admired his work, and I did some work for him, too, when I was in commercial art.
Oh, cool. That's neat the way that you're all connected that way, to be working in editorial work and then come into picture books together.
That's right. We were always sort of like editorial magazines and things like that.
Yeah.
And then it was about the same time Maurice Sendak was beginning to, he was actually discovered by the same editor, Ursula Nostrum. And I met him in Ursula Nostrum's apartment once. He was a young guy also. So, So it was a beginning of my era, you know, around that time in 1962.
I think, Ed, about where you all came from, thinking about coming from places like architecture and that editorial work, those books then and now, picture books now, you can see that there's a sophistication to the art and there's a respect for the child, but also, as you're saying, you're telling stories not just for children, but for the adults. And so there's something about your art that I've always admired that does feel that way, that feels sophisticated, feels complex, it feels challenging, and I think that it's something that makes it beautiful.
Yes, I learned a great deal from architecture. I'm still in love with buildings and spaces, and then in advertising, I learned to actually find out what is a crucial aspect, the key of a storyline, and how to emphasize it, and how to appeal to the eye, and all that kind of thing. And then also to complete something quickly within deadlines and things like that. It's a very disciplined kind of field, although it's very harsh and competitive.
Have you found children's books to be loving, embracing, more celebratory in your time that you've been in picture books?
When I first got into it, definitely.
Okay.
But picture book itself, as a publishing company, are being swallowed, merging, and becoming more owning by big companies like Walt Disney and things like that. It has beginning to lose its own the humanness of it.
Oh.
It's approaching to become more like a commercial thing, and that's actually the whole field of books, except for people like yourself, librarians and teachers are still book lovers. But when you go into a bookstore, unless it's a private bookstore, you go to Barnes & Noble's, people who sell books don't know much about books. They just take your money and get you the book. They have no love for it. So actually, that's becoming so. And then in the publishing business, it used to be the editors who stand behind you. They have the full power. And they pick a book and they stand behind it. And nowadays, it's the marketing. There's a committee of people who make decisions.
Yes.
So it's become corporations much more than it's personal.
Well, I love in the swing back with all of our connectivity over technology that we do have librarians and teachers now championing books.
Oh, yeah.
And connecting to others, and we're seeing it on Facebook or Instagram or just being shared over and over. So it's nice the way that when you came up and you had booksellers and editors championing your books, we now have this community that is, even though we're far apart, we're still able to be connected through that technology and share.
Yeah, I think that if it's not for people like you, I won't be in this business. You know, it's actually going both ways. I cannot thank you people enough for me to have the opportunity to tell stories that I love.
Wow.
I would not be working, as I haven't been working for advertising. It's because it doesn't have the heart in what you do.
Well, I'm so glad that not only do you see the heart in the people that are still there now, that it is still there, but that the books you're creating, I feel like you're at the top of your game. You're making these beautiful, beautiful books. And I was blessed to most recently come across The Cat from Hunger Mountain and also Mighty Moby, which I know comes out at the beginning of next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you seen it already?
I have. I got an early copy of it. It was so wonderful. Why don't we talk about the Cat from Hunger Mountain first, though, because that's out now and people will be able to find it. This story, this folktale, this legend, if you will, is this a story that you've known for some time? This was a new story for me.
I have known this story not when I was a child. I have been reading many Chinese stories when I'm in children's books, and when I start to write, I wanted to actually get into stories about China that is seldom known in America, and there is a flavor of the Chinese mentality and intelligence, which oftentimes, when in the old days, I did illustration for American writers about China, it's a romanticized kind of Hollywood version, which is not quite expressing the guts of the Chinese people. So I was reading a lot more Chinese stories when I was in this country, as well as when I was younger in China. And in China, I read a lot of historical stories. They are folk tales and stories, but then I read them for myself. But then when I was in America, I was reading the Chinese stories for the Americans. And one of those stories is Hunger Mountain, but then it was one of the many stories. How did that come about? I used to have a publishing company called Philomel, which is where Hunger Mountain came from.
Oh.
And it was Philomel that was my major publishing house, and I had gone through many editors, one after another. They were all retiring. I just went from one. I started with Anne Benedu. She was slightly older than me, and she picked up and my beginning, and she gave me a number of stories in trade books. I think with trade books, I did most of the books for her. She championed me, and then she retired after she created Philomel. And Pat Gouch came in, and she continued with that tradition, and I got two Caldecotts with her and one Caldecott with Anne Benedu.
Yes, yes. And
then when Pat Gouch retired, then I stopped working for Philomel, and I picked up other publishing houses. And then Michael Green was the intern when I stopped. And then, of course, now he has become the chief editor. And he called me just last year, and he said, Ed, you haven't done books with Philomel for a while. I'd like to do a book with you sometime. I said, sure. What kind of stories do you want to hear? So he said, if you have any stories. I said, I have plenty of stories. So we met at my agent's place in the city, and I brought in a number of stories that I have illustrated. That's the way I work. I usually read the stories that I liked. I do the book already without anybody buying it.
Oh, wow.
I usually just tell the story visually just to as an exercise for me. It's really telling a story visually.
Do you mean that tell it without any words at all? You just create the story through illustration?
No. If I read a story that I love, I do a book of it already.
Yes, okay. I got it, yeah.
Full book, but then I draw pictures for it, just on the manuscript sometimes, on my pad. I just conceive the stories and I put it down what I saw in my mind. So I brought those in. And then one of them he liked, it was called The Magic Hat. It was a Japanese story. And I said, well, all right, I love the story too. So why don't we do that one? And he said, good. And then as he was leaving and we were getting our coats to go, I said, Michael, do you have any stories you have in mind? And he said, yeah, but I don't have time to write. He does everything in the company, so he doesn't have time. So I said, well, tell me the story then. So he told me this Cafe on Hunger Mountain, except it was not in China. That's one thing. And then the other thing is that it was a person, you know. And then I said, I have a story similar to that. Maybe let me tell you my story to see whether if it's what you're telling to begin with.
Yeah.
But I told him this story. He said, that's it. I said, well, then let's go with it, because it is your story. It's also my story. Why don't we do this one? That's how it started. And it's very different than anything I've done in the past, because it's either that the company has a story for me to illustrate, and then I do the illustrate. Or I have a story, I approach them, I say, I want to tell the story and illustrate. Or I have a story. But never a story that he tells me and I tell him back. So it's our story.
I love that you have that. At this point in your career, too, to have gone through all of these different experiences and to now still be having first experiences.
Yeah, it makes it a lot easier, because he wants to tell a story which is similar to what I want to tell the story. So I started to do the drawing because the story is in my head, and I just started with with approaching the whole thing without a manuscript. I just did it from my head. And then the story is almost... The book is almost done. It's three quarters through. I said, well, I got to put words in there now. I really don't, you know, you have to have words already. You can match with the pages. So I called up Michael. I said, Michael, what about the words? You know, we know the story, but we have to let the readers know the story, and it had to have the words in it. He said, yeah, but why don't you write something? And then I will edit it. So I start sort of putting the words to the pictures, and then I sent that to him, and then he edited. And then he came over to my place. First time he sent the designer to me, and I said, Michael, you got to come and see it, because this is the time for you to edit it and tell me what pictures, whether the picture is just on the way that you have in mind. Because I changed it to cats. The rich man actually was a man, and I decided that I want to tell the story without pinpointing what a man looked like, but the character of the man is such that readers can put the character into any culture they want to, and any people that they can imagine. So I decide to use the animals to personalize the character. So the man becomes a cat, which is a lazy fat cat, and then I decided to have the panda for the cook, and the builder, the rat for the builder, and then the falcon for the hunter, and the peacock become the tailor, and so forth.
Yes.
And he went for it. I know it's much more like a folk tale. So and then I said, if it's not along the way you see the, there's still time for me to change them. But then if I will go any further, you don't see them. The next time you see it is going to be finished art.
Really,
and
fun,
there's very little bit you can talk about, because when it's done, I'm not going to change it. So he came the second time. The first time he sent the designers, the second time he came and he said, you know, I need to have another picture of the panda washing the rice in the front.
And okay.
I said, Michael, I told you you should be here the first time because there's no time for me to change it. You're set. You know, I said, this is why I asked you to come to see you, because it is time for me to change it, but now you tell me that you need another spread in the middle. Why am I going to squeeze that in? So finally, I sat down. You know, actually, the famine was, I had 3 years of famine. You know, the first year, and then the second year, and by the time the third year, he cannot, you know, he lost all his familiarity with the people. His workers left him, his family left him, and then finally, he was by himself in a desolate place. But I said, well, then we have to cut one more year. I have to cut 1 year out of the 3 years to create the spread.
Yes.
So it became sort of like it was famine the first year and it was famine the second year. And then we went on to say he lost everything. So he had to go begging. And then I created that spread for him, the cat screaming in the house with the panda washing the rice in the waterfall. That was a new one that I put in.
I'm looking at it right now, and I love the composition of that so much. It's funny to think that that was a late addition into the story.
Yeah, it got in there, and I was afraid that it's not quite, you know, you know, when you do something which is sort of added in, sometimes it stands out too much. It doesn't get the flow of it. But it seems like it works right into it without standing out too much.
Well,
I think it
beautifully mirrors the spread that precedes it, though, where we have the panda bringing the cat lord a bowl of rice and the view, the sort of the scenery in the background looking out over the mountains, and then to turn and to instead have it looking sort of back into his temple, and to also have the panda there on now the opposite side.
I was afraid that if I have too many pandas of the same kind of composition, it feels like repetition.
Yeah.
So actually, I turned the whole thing around. The panda was on the left-hand side first, and he was screaming on the right-hand side, so I decided to flip it around.
Yeah.
So the first picture is panda on the left page facing him on the right, and then the last one, the second one, was actually he's on the left in the building and screaming at the panda leaning over, washing the rice on the right. So it seems like, you know, sometimes when you only have one view and you repeat it, it seems like redundant, you know. So it's all about the flow.
I loved it. What I took away from it, from reading that illustration, and just to give the people that will listen to this context for the story of this lord that lives high up in a mountain that is so wasteful and is so want for things that he is willing to let all of his rice or excess of his rice just wash down the river. And then one day becomes, you know, enters a famine and becomes very poor. I loved that on the spreads we were just talking about, that really that second spread where we see the panda washing, where the cat is on the left-hand side, we really leave the cat in the rest of the book there, which is nice that it's then on the left-hand side, because then we proceed on and famine comes and that cat is left behind to suffer by himself while life moves on. I thought when I read it, I thought, wow, this is brilliant that it's moving this way. So to hear again that it was a late edition spread just is beautiful, that you had the vision for how that could be translated then?
Well, many of that is sort of unconsciously composed. I was actually, you know, when I make a book, it's on the long table. I can see all the pictures in sequence.
Yes.
You know, when you read a book, you have to take one spread at a time.
And you can walk down your long, I've seen pictures of your long table, that you can walk the table and therefore walk the book.
You can walk the book because it's very important how you turn the page and what your anticipation of the second page, you know, the next spread and before it. In your mind, you retain that as if you're reading something or listen to music. You don't actually see the note, but you actually see the sequence of the note that makes the music. And making a book, you have to actually, your mind does the continuation. You retain the last picture, you go into the next one. So it's very similar to music in that way, which is different than if you're looking at paintings, because each one is singular by a shell telling the story. So if you look at pictures by sequence, the rhythm of it is like going through a movie.
Yes. So in the other book that we brought up, in Mighty Moby, which comes out in January, did you then start more traditional to your process with that book, that you had the story and you created these illustrations and then Barbara DaCosta came and added text to it? Or did you have her text before you did the illustrations?
I actually, the book, when I had it, it was actually without any words. I just did the pictures of it. And I live, Hastings is actually north of New York City on the Hudson River. And I had the idea, it wasn't the whale then. It wasn't, at that time, it wasn't the whale. It was a monster. And then I heard that there was a whaling museum up the Hudson River, and I was curious whether that whale was in the Hudson River at one time, because up to West Point, the water of the sea comes into the Hudson River and changes into clear water there. You know, the tide of the ocean actually come up the river.
Oh, wow, there's an estuary there at West Point. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, in fact, recently there was a humpback actually came into the Hudson River.
Wow.
It was a sensation because people actually filmed it of this whale that actually got into the Hudson River and swam around the harbor and eventually went out to sea.
That would have been something to witness. Wow.
And then, of course, you know, everybody just taking pictures like crazy. At that time, when I got the picture, I thought, what if this whale is the Hunter? So actually the name is like Moby on the Hudson. That was the first title.
Moby and on I the just, Hudson. Wow. Okay. And the whole feel of it to me is, I mean, obviously, the feel to me is Moby Dick.
Yeah. Well, I played out Moby Dick, but it's actually in the Hudson River with the Palisades and things like that. But then it changed, you know, become more and more, and then we decided to actually put words in there. And then so at that time, Barbara had already done the Nighttime Ninja with me.
Yes.
And I asked whether Barbara can actually put the words in there. She is a very dedicated scholar. She loved Moby Dick, and she had read it many times, and she thoroughly researched it, and she created the rhymes and the the singing of the sailors, you know, all of those are based very well researched. And she made it to feel like, you know, Bobby, it was real, you know. And then that actually gradually became Moby Dick. And I wanted to feel like real so that you wouldn't suspect that it was actually imagination of a child. So it echoes, if you're familiar with Nighttime Danger, it's actually, in the end, it flipped, and then you realize it's really in the head of a boy.
Right. And I think readers that are aware of that book, and if you're aware of your work with Barbara, will know that. But still, to be drawn into, I mean, in Nighttime Ninja, we were drawn into this quiet world where you're creeping around this building.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in here, to have the danger, I mean, you're building these two great distractions that allow you to be surprised at the end, because the whale in this, again, your compositions go so large in scale that the whale in many of the spreads cannot fit onto the page. We're seeing glimpses of the fin and of the tail and of the eyes. It's just great. And I love your collage work, the paper that you have that just feels the swirling together, the textures that juxtapose to make it look the way that it does, that marbled paper. When you go, my favorite spread is the spread that reads, "It dived into the deep, dark water," and the whale's tail is red, and the water is just this like gold and marbled black. Ugh. And my son, I have a 6-year-old son, and he said, "Daddy, why is the tail red?" And I said, "Well, did you see the harpoon? Do you know what's going on?" It's just amazing. The emotion that is evoked in that illustration is it's so powerful.
Well, a lot of it is using the color to enhance the anger and, of course, you know, the bloodiness of the sport. Well, it wasn't a sport, but then it's still the revenge, you know, in the captain, you know, who's so bent on finding the whale to revenge a past thing. But then it's for me the power, much of it is in the color, but the color also is the bloodiness of it. That whale is definitely injured, and then he's actually diving, and the captain is pulled into it. And I just want to get the suspense of that moment of the helplessness of the people against this huge thing.
Oh yeah, and I love it. That the size, the helplessness, the one of the final spreads where the whale is bursting from the water and the men on the bottom half of the page, because you have a lot of those spreads where you have to turn the book on its side to see the images like bursting out of the book, but to see in that picture the boats.
I was playing with, you know, I have to fit those things in.
Yeah.
And then how do you people read it? You have to start turning the book around in, you know, different directions.
So there's this thing about your book here that I noticed that seems unconventional in publishing, which is that when you do these long spreads, I need to turn the right side of the book up. Whereas it seems like most times I see it, I turn it the opposite direction. But what I've found then is that, wait, well, when I do it your way, though, then as my hand moves back into position to flip the page, I'm actually progressing the story forward instead of like fumbling backwards to fix
right.
it. It just seems like...
That is a choice. You know, I can do it the other way also. It makes the reading different. You probably noticed that. You know, the Chinese read actually a book from the right to the left.
Yes.
And so the first page is actually the opening is on the left side. So you actually open the page from the left to the right. And then the lines go vertical. As you go through the book, it goes the other way. So I'm not saying that any one way is right or left. You know, it's just a choice. You
it
know,
is a
and
choice.
Then it happened to be that way, and then then the Western is the other way. But then it's just two different ways. It's like in Britain, you actually drive on the left hand side,
right.
And then over in the United States, you drive on the right hand side. But then it's the choice.
But how it works then in the end of this story, when you have several spreads that are told by turning the book on its side, is that you can actually let each page fall down as the whale is bursting from the water, that spread I was talking about. You can let page fall down to reveal the next, and let the following fall down to reveal the next, like a calendar mm-hmm. falling down or something. I guess that would be going back in time. But it just, again, as looking at the book as a tool, as a medium for storytelling,
are actually hitting it right on the butt. I think the book is an item, and then as you turn, you really don't know that turning is a part of the activity enhancing the reading. It's the two things that are related. So your motions with your hand on the book either help the reading or does not help the reading.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, I have one book that I did. I don't know whether you have read it. It's called The Foolish Rabbit's Big Mistake. I want the picture to come out at you as you open the pages. And then I want the animal to be hopping from the left to the right as you turn the page.
Yes.
You know, the actions of the turning of the page or turning of the book enhances the story. And then when you go, let's say, an animal running from the right to the left, it's actually stopping the motion of the reading. You know, so it slows down the reading as you go from the left to the right. It should speed up the reading. So these are working with the habit of the reading, because the eye actually does move from the left to the right as you read. And the hand does flip from the right to the left. And so each of these motions has something to do with the reading process. And as you read it, as a teacher to the children, they listen to it. They don't get through the actions like you do. So a reader who turns the pages is involved in the reading very different than the person who listened to you reading.
Yes, I completely agree. It's neat to consider that both what the reader is experiencing as you read aloud to them, but also as the reader, the experience that you're having, and how important then to make sure that the child gets the chance to hold the book in his or her hands and tell the story and make this story progress by his or her own hands.
Yes, and there are also books that you actually flip the page with the people who are looking at you. Those have to be pretty big books because, you know, people are sitting in front of you. You can actually turn the book to them. Those are actually like calendars. You could actually flip the pages downward. It's much easier to turn a book. And then you can turn the book the other way, facing them and turning the pages, let them fall down.
Yeah.
That is a book to be shared by listener and the reader.
Yeah.
These are, you know, it's actually making a book, the designer had to think of how the book is to be read. Because it's a participation between the reader and the people who are listening, or the reader by himself. These are very different kind of books. You know, let's say there are books which are very small. It enhances you to take it into your own secret place, and then you just read it by yourself.
Yes.
That's a intimate kind of reading. So the act of reading is very different, and the stories are very different. And each one is, it requires you to consider how it's going to be read, and then you design the book to enhance that.
Yes. Well, Ed, as I wrap up my time with you, I feel like you've given so much for me to think about. I love it. And I couldn't help but think about that world that you started, the world that you entered, where children's books were just starting to become the art that they are, and you grew up in that world. And also now how in China, they're going through a renaissance in children's books too. And experiencing that, and just how beautiful this whole thing has been. But I wanted to end my conversation with you by bringing it back to readers, and I wanted to ask you a question that I didn't tell you ahead of time, but we'll give you a chance to respond directly to those readers and send a message to them. So, Ed, I'm going to see a library full of children tomorrow morning, being a school librarian. I'd love to know what message, as an author, as a storyteller, as an artist, what message can I bring to them from you?
Well, children are natural artists before 9-year-old. There's a cutting point. You probably will experience that if you're a librarian. When children starting to draw pictures, every children is an artist. But then when they reach the age where they want to draw realistically from what they see, some of them does much better than others, and those became what other poor people call artists, and the one who couldn't do that would actually be working themselves in else. But what I want to say is that if they have stories, they should tell it the way they do. They don't have to be realistic. And being realistic does not necessarily make you an artist. So the skill of drawing is not important. It is the heart that tells the story that's the most important thing.
This podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 250 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them, Books Between, a podcast hosted by Karina Allen, helping to connect kids ages 8 to 12 and their parents, teachers, and librarians with books that they'll love, and the Best Book Ever This Week podcast, hosted by me, with book reviews about all sorts of amazing books. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referred to. Listeners, if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment at allthewonders.com or rate this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing this podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. Coming up on the podcast, Claire Legrand shares Some Kind of Happiness, a breathtaking, transporting middle grade novel. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.